You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. I've got a wonderful guest for you today. Lord David Putnam. He's an idealistic man who's had a red hot go, as they say, at changing the world for the better. And he's had a lot of fun in the process. David Putnam is, of course, the film producer who brought you The Mission, The Killing Fields, Chariots of Fire and Midnight Express and others as well. He was even head of Columbia Pictures for a while. Some years ago, he was appointed to the House of Lords in the UK, where he's now able to follow his other passions, specifically education, media diversity and climate change. Lord David Putnam is in Australia as president of the 2010 Asia-Pacific Screen Awards jury, and he's been giving the keynote address, The Value of Cinema in the Digital Age. Lord Putnam, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks very much, Richard.
You're only the second Lord we've had on this program, and Lord Robert Winston was the other one.
He's a good friend of mine. He's probably a lot more better value than me.
I don't know about that. I think you're both very different men. I think my idea of the ideal dinner party would be to have either the two of you in a room sort of locked up over a bottle of wine. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Well, we've both got very nice wives, and maybe that's what keeps us sane.
Maybe that's what it is. Your keynote address, The Value of Cinema in the Digital Age. Cinemas will change. I mean, more of us are getting big, impressive screens in our own living rooms. How do you see the act of going to the cinema changing in the near future?
I've watched this, obviously, for 50 years as a film grower, more than 50 years as a film grower, and 40 years as a professional. I think you underestimate the collective experience of cinema at your peril. Generation after generation after generation doesn't just go because it's the great international date. They go because there is something happens. If you watch a comedy at home, it's can be fun, but it's not the same thing as being in an audience that where the laughter ripples around, or there's someone with a particularly raucous laugh in the front that kicks off laughter where it was probably never intended. Similarly, with tension, there's now odd paradox associated with cinema, because it is at one and the same time the most immersive form of entertainment that's ever been invented. I mean, you literally do live those characters. There's a reason that actors and actresses are attractive. It's because we effectively loan them our personalities, and we want to loan our personalities to attractive people. So it's immersive on the one hand, but it's also collective. And I think there's a sort of magic in that paradox, that we both share the experience with people around us, and yet it is at the same time intensely personal. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I'm not sure how that nexus quite works, but I think it has worked, it does work, and it will continue to work.
It's a very dreamlike experience going to the movies, isn't it? The lights dim, and then something sort of comes up. You feel that it's almost like one's own personality is being submerged, as you say, or transferred. I never thought of it as being transferred into the presence on the screen, but it is. It's quite dreamlike. It's almost like lucid dreaming.
I had a really interesting experience. Saturday evening, I saw a preview of a film called The King's Speech. Really good movie, Colin Firth and Geoffrey Rush. Really good film. And I sat and watched it, and I knew the story a bit, and I was admiring the acting. The acting's excellent and everything else. And at the very end of the film, I'm not giving anything away here, the camera cranes up behind Colin Firth playing King George VI. And what you see is you rise, you're on the balcony of Buckingham Palace, and there's a sea of people in front of you, and it's 1939. And I started to weep almost uncontrollably. Richard, you've got to believe me, it came from inside somewhere. I had no idea where it came from. And I was sobbing. My chest was... And it had got me. Cinema got me again. And I'd never thought of myself as a royalist. There's something about it. And I think it hit an echo of something in my childhood, maybe. You know, I was a post-war child. It found something in me that I'd forgotten was there. Now, how about that for a medium?
I was going to ask you about this later, but I'll bring it up now. I don't cry much in movies. I don't tear up very often, but I did at the end of The Killing Fields, which is a movie you produced, the scene of the reunion that's at the end of that movie. And the fact that it's filmed so simply, it's it's simply shot, but it's a very shocking moment emotionally. I don't know why. I just wondered if I teared up and felt a bit embarrassed in the cinema as a result of that scene. I wonder if you teared up in that same scene as well.
Yes, I did. I mean, it's worth dwelling on that for a second, because there are three moments in the film which where that emotion is completely appropriate, maybe even four. Early on, you've got the moment when, which is all done in Khmer, which is quite daring, I think, at the time, where you know that Pran is telling his family he's going to stay, and he's going to send his wife and children out, but he's going to stay. And the wife is it's in the kitchen, and the wife is crying, and the whole scene is done in Khmer. There's no subtitles. You know exactly what's going on. And that, I find, is quite an emotional scene. And then you've got a scene which should have been the wipeout scene, actually. And that was when, in the end, after all the struggles to try and make a fake passport, do you remember, in the embassy, they fail, and Pran gets sent out, Hang Nor gets sent out. And it's very emotional. There's a lot of slow build to it. And it's never made me or anyone else, to my knowledge, cry. And it should, because it's beautifully, beautifully shot. I mean, Roland did, as Pran leaves the embassy, there's an amazing shot that ends up as a close-up on Sam Waterston's face. It doesn't. There's something missing, and we cut it endlessly. I cannot tell you how many times we tried to cut it and recut it and change it, because you know the emotions are there, but we never delivered them. There's a third one in the film, which certainly has provoked tears, which is when the child, yes, remember, is carrying and the fragmentation grenade. Yes. And that, I thought, we did well, because we kept it wide. We played it wide, and it's only when you see the smoke going up and he's rocking with the child, you realize the child's dead. That did make a lot of people cry. But you're also quite right. The ending, when they get together, well, you've got Imagine on the soundtrack, which I got criticized for at the time, but actually would have been. It was the most popular song in the world at that moment. Remember, he comes out of the car, yes, and on the car radio there's the song Imagine, and then the music creeps up behind them. Yeah, you've got to be quite a hard ass for that not to get you. You've just lived with those guys for almost 2 hours. You've been through a lot with them. They've been through a lot with each other. You've got to be a tough guy not for it to get to you.
It was something about the pose of Sam Waterston sitting in the car playing Sidney Shanbeck, isn't it? Yeah, something, yeah, that he's sitting there. He's too tall for the car or something, and he looks kind of human and vulnerable at that moment. It's just a whole lot of small things that make up a very emotional scene.
And lovely line as well, which is the true line, when Sidney says, forgive me. And Hang Nor says, nothing to forgive, Sidney, nothing to forgive. So in that, I'd like to think what you reacted to was that we played it in quite a muted way. You know, there was no air punching, there was nothing big.
No.
And I think that its effect came from the degree to which it was somewhat muted.
It was a film about something that where the world, where the larger world, the first world or the West, if you want to call it, and it was a thing where that part of the world wanted to turn its gaze away from Cambodia, that what was going on there. It's just too horrible to look at, and to see scenes of the news, it can feel kind of visually and morally exhausting. I just think it's interesting that a movie like that can take a situation that you can't bear to look at and turn it into a movie, and then you can't bear to look away once it becomes cinema.
I think that's absolutely true. There's a story I was told it the other day in a lecture. It's well worth repeating. I'll try and give the short version. Just after the film won its clutch of Oscars, I was invited by the British Council to take the film to Kiev to a kind of international UK cultural week in Ukraine. And I went there with a movie. I'd been rather badly briefed. I had no idea of the tensions that existed at that time in the Ukraine, religious
tensions.
What
period was this?
This is 1985.
All right, the height of the Cold War. This is pre-Gorbachev.
Very much. But within, and as a sort of microcosm, within what was happening in Russia, there were tremendous tensions in Ukraine, part of the Ukraine which saw itself as Russian, part of the Ukraine which saw itself as European, and two religions side by side. It was tough. None of that had been explained to me. We ran the film on a Saturday morning, 2,000 young people, mostly young people, in a vast cavernous cinema, and it played well, and there was a Q&A session afterwards. And this is what was absolutely amazing. Not one single question ever mentioned Cambodia. They all talked about the Ukraine. Could that happen here? What are the circumstances? It was all they completely registered it as that something that happens in a country which is going through a crisis or schism. So that was what the discussion was. Cut to 19, I'll probably get the year wrong, it doesn't really matter, 1998. I'm in Davos, walking down a corridor, and I'm introduced to the new president of Ukraine, Yushchenko. Remember the man who had the...
Yeah, it was poisoned, wasn't it?
Huge guy. And I threw the interpreter, didn't speak much English, threw the interpreter, I hear him say, he's Putnam, and he's a producer of the Killing Fields. And this huge bear of a man picks me up, and he's bouncing me up. And what I managed to get from him through the interpreter again was that the film, he said, your film was shown in schools throughout the Ukraine. He didn't actually mention pirated, but clearly shown in schools throughout the Ukraine. And he said to me, do you remember during the Orange Revolution, with all the problems that were going on, no one ever even thought about or mentioned the possibility of a civil war? He said, we'd all seen your film. We knew what happened when a nation collapses into civil war, and that was not going to happen in Ukraine. And he said, we really owe you. Now, let's get this clear. When Roland and I and Bruce Robinson were working on the movie, it never crossed our minds that it could ever have that kind of an effect.
Yeah, let's save the Ukraine from, let's preempt civil war in the Ukraine.
But anyone that makes a movie with serious intent that doesn't realise that the residual impact on people they would never meet or countries they may never go to can be that profound is dumb, because that's what cinema can do, and that's the potential of cinema.
Lord David Putnam is here, film producer and a man who's been hugged by the president of Ukraine. He's my guest in conversation. I don't want to have a long conversation with you about whither Australian cinema, because that happens, that goes on for too often. But we're having a good, we seem to be going through a pretty good cycle at the moment. We've got films like Animal Kingdom, which is, you know, a fantastic film. And it's doing well, box office-wise. It's getting a lot of interest overseas. But, you know, we have our ups and downs. I wonder, is it like that in the UK as well? Does UK cinema periodically go through these a crisis of confidence like Australian cinema does?
Very much so. I mean, during the period of my career, I started roughly 1970, I would say there's been at least three highs and an equal number of lows in the UK. The Australian circumstance for me is very, very vivid at the moment, because I first came here 31 years ago. I came as a guest of the Australian Film Commission. I'd just done Midnight Express, and I was asked to work with a number of filmmakers and on scripts and things. And it was a wonderful 6 weeks. Now, during that period, I met Jane Campion, I met Gillian Armstrong, I met Peter Weir, I met Bruce Beresford, I met Fred Skepsey, George Miller. I mean, my entire generation, really, if you like, of filmmakers, all of whom in different ways were developing careers and confidence. And it was an extraordinary explosion. Now, nothing quite like that's ever happened since. I mean, it's quite, Phil Noyce would be another one. I mean, all those people are actually still making movies. And if you like, they are, to an extent, the dominant generation of American cinema today. And I wonder what this is. And when I say I wonder, I really mean I wonder. This is me theorizing here. Was it that that generation cast such a long shadow that it was difficult for young filmmakers to kind of step up and join that pretty elite group, number one? Secondly, have we been through a Peter Costello, who I saw the other day, was mentioning that there hasn't been a recession in Australia since 1991. Has it been that politically and socially there haven't been the sharpness of the issues to engage with that justify a big movie, for example? I mean, when you think about it, an awful lot of Australian films in the last 20 years have dwelt in the past. They've tended to, even the very best of them, they've tended to be looking back, not certainly not forward, and very few of them I would regard as absolutely contemporary. What does that say about the filmmakers? What does it say about the stories they want to tell? What does it say about the audience? And is it time for a new generation of younger Australian filmmakers to grip the very real issues this country is going through, its relationship with China, its ever-decreasing, in a sense, relationship with the United States, the fact that it is, to all intents and purposes, certainly as compared to when I was here 31 years ago, shed its relationship with the UK. Now, this is a nation in transition. A lot of that transition represents opportunity. A lot of that transition represents threat. You know, I would love to see a really serious Australian movie about the way in which over the next 3, 4, 5 years the relationship with China might develop, or indeed how it might fracture. Now, that's good stuff, and that's very, very fertile ground for a filmmaker, particularly as you've got also got some very, very good Asian filmmakers living and working here in this country. So I guess this is me trying to urge on another generation to not be intimidated by what was a golden generation, but to start carving out careers for themselves.
David, just before we went to where you told me what your favourite Australian film was. It's an interesting choice. Explain what it is and why it is your favourite Australian film.
My favourite Australian film, in fact, one of my favourite films of all time anywhere, is The Castle. Because I think that it is a film which is absolutely lives in the eye of the beholder. My wife and I use it in a very interesting way. We test people with it. So when they come and stay with us, for example, we will always try and show the castle. If they don't get it, we probably don't invite them again. Because the film, it's absolutely true.
There you are, world, you're on notice.
The film has a kind of humanity to it. And if you take a supercilious view of it, or if you approach that film the wrong way, you're saying something about you. However, if you're prepared to embrace that film and its deeper values, and it's got very, I think it's got hugely deep values, you probably are a very decent person who has got quite a lot to offer the world. And it's, there are not many films, actually, for me, that offer a real litmus test as to how human you truly are.
You have an Oscar. Do you have more than one?
I've got one of my own. I've won 10.
Are they in the pool room?
They're not in the pool room, but maybe they ought to be. No, everything I've ever won is at the National Museum of Photography, Film and Television in Bradford. And interestingly enough, there's a friend of mine, Roger Law, who now lives in Sydney, who did Spitting Image. And I bought, probably self-protectively, I bought my Spitting Image caricature and gave it to the museum. And my Oscar is sitting on the lap of my Sitting Image Spitting Image caricature in Bradford.
Now, while you were in Australia, you made an interesting call for film and TV producers to make their content available for educational purposes. Does that mean amending the Copyright Act, or is that not really the point? I'm just wondering, what's the benefit of that and why you're calling for that and how that could
This
work?
Is something I've been arguing for a long time, and it's a polarised argument. I've actually been trying to insert myself into a debate and discussion which is going nowhere. It is, you've got one group of people to whom the notion of copyright is a sort of holy writ, and another group of people to whom the notion that everything's free and everything should be free is the way the world ought to go. Both are wrong. Both are very clearly wrong. I've been arguing for something that I call free use protocols, which is you look at a piece of material, you judge where it could be of real value. You talk to school teachers, not lawyers. You talk to school teachers. How would you use this clip? How could you use bits of this film to actually enhance the teaching of being a good citizen, for example, or history, or whatever it might be? Once you establish the fact that these films can have real value in building the type of society we want to live in, then there ought to be what I would call free use protocols, which allow, or which are quite permissive and allow those uses, and without getting interfered with by lawyers and everything else. Truth is, if someone said to me, you know, those two scenes in Chariots of Fire about, it's a very good scene indeed, where Eric Liddell explains to his sister why he feels he has to run. If someone said, I really need that to show a particular aspect of religion, what on earth would I say no? What possible damage could it do me as the rights holder? You know, I earn good royalties from Chariots of Fire. As I see it, it's only going to make it more likely that kids seeing that clip are going to want to go and see the film, which is great. And does this, as I say, unfortunately, this has become a neurotic debate dominated by lawyers with deep suspicion as a result of the mistakes, without doubt mistakes, that the music industry made. But if we can just, the way I explained it in the speech I did this week, you know, Teddy Kennedy, at Robert Kennedy's funeral, has that famous phrase, some men ask why, my brother always asked why not. And that's what I'd like people to start doing about copyright. Don't just say, I own this thing, therefore no one else can touch it. Just say, has it got real value? Could it be used in contexts where actually it could promote the kind of world we want to live in? If so, for God's sake, you know, ease up and try and make that possible. You know, this difference between I don't want it used, or why not, let's look at how it could be used, is only a small shift, but it could be a dramatic shift in using copyright properly.
Lord David Putnam is my guest in conversation. You're very involved in education in the House of Lords at the moment, yep. The House of Lords is empowered to scrutinise all kinds of bills, and you certainly do that. Where does this come from, this passion for education?
Well, weirdly, Richard, it's to do with the fact that I was so poorly educated. I had one really great teacher, one named Miss Kirkpatrick, who was my history teacher, who was marvellous, and I did very, very well in history. But more worryingly, I had teachers who had no faith in me whatsoever. In fact, I had one teacher to a degree brutalised me over what today is seen as quite an interesting psychological issue, which is that I was very, very good at mental arithmetic and not very good when asked to sit down and write out and show how I'd arrived at the answer I'd arrived at. Now, as I say, contemporary psychiatrists could write a small book on what that's about. It actually is illustrative of a particular type of brain. But at my school, it was illustrative of just being defiant and difficult, and I got beaten for it time and time and time again, to the extent that eventually I started truanting, and I truanted for an entire term, which is not the smartest way to deal with a kid with a problem in maths.
Yet you're clearly a learned and erudite man. Are you an autodidact? You've taught yourself all these things.
What happened was, I because I was unhappy, I got out of school as quickly as I could when I was 16 with the minimum of qualifications, woke up at 18 and realised that wasn't going to cut it, and went back to night school. So for 4 years, I went to night school. But the difference was, those 4 years, I created my own curriculum, and I studied some really interesting things. I mean, fantastic things. Psychology in relation to advertising. I did an economics course. I had a great time. And I discovered that I really loved learning. And the truth is, I've loved learning all of my life. I am almost an obsessive learner. And one of the great ironies of my life is I now end up as a chancellor of the Open University, which is the kind of quintessence,
yes, yes,
of a quintessential answer to the problem that I faced at age 18.
What advice? Tell me about the advice you got from your career advisor in high school as you left.
You've been reading the cuts. It was dreadful. He was actually the deputy head, Dr. Packer, but except that when he was doing career advice, he took his gown off and was in mufti. And we had this absurd conversation, which was kind of mocking. You know that thing where teachers can mock you?
Oh, yeah.
And he said, Putnam, he said, you've managed to convince the examiners that you're thick. What do you intend to do with your life? I said, I don't really know, sir. He said, well, I've got some advice for you. He said, I think you should become a rep. I said, what's a rep, sir? I was only 16. Huh? What's a rep, sir? A rep, he said, you work for a packaged goods company and you travel around the country and you fulfill orders and deliver things. So not a bad life at all. I said, well, like a van driver. So he said, no, boy. If you want to be a van driver, you could have gone to a secondary modern school. No. No, a rep is a cut above a van driver. I said, well, it's not really what I had in mind, sir, to be absolutely honest. So with which he put this terrible sneer on his face. He said, well, let me tell you, sonny, it's the only way I could ever imagine you owning a car. And that was... that was the end of me at school. I kind of left that day and I do have a car.
You do have a car.
I want to make very clear. I actually do have my own car and I paid for it.
You've done well. You've done well. Okay. You own your car. That's lovely. When it comes to education reform and the state of Britain schools and the like, your firm belief is that it's all about teacher quality, isn't it? Tell me about how that thinking has evolved.
Well, it's I've basically worked in the world of education for about 15 years now. I had a fantastic 6 years at the very centre of it, working for the Secretary of State for Education, who was an amazing woman. And as a result, I've read a lot of research reports and everything else. And one thing becomes very clear. I've also travelled a lot in educational circles, that no education system in the world can ever be better than the quality of its average teacher. So the whole issue of teacher quality and the ambition of teachers and professional training of teachers and retraining of teachers is fundamental to having a successful education. Finland is a very good example. They attract their teachers from the top quartile of university graduates. The US is a very good example of the opposite, where teachers, for the most part, come from the bottom quartile of university graduates. We are somewhere, in the UK, we're somewhere in between. But the key is in a very, very fast-moving world of education, where technology is playing a bigger and bigger role. You've got to give teachers the opportunity to have time out to restudy and upskill themselves so that they can remain relevant within their own classrooms. Teachers are not necessarily very confident people. They're lovely people, but they don't necessarily have a whole lot of confidence. And I think the most important thing society needs to do is remind them how valuable they are, because we won't have a society without them. Secondly, the degree to which we want to encourage them to be the very best they can be. And thirdly, the degree to which we're prepared to invest in them to ensure that a 30-year-old teacher who's been teaching for 5-6 years is able to take a few months off to upskill herself. I mean, I'm sitting here holding my iPad today. You know, every teacher really should be entirely familiar with an iPad. Actually, every teacher should be given an iPad and see it as a fundamental tool of the way in which they deal with their class. Why? Because the kids they're dealing with will all work off the equivalent of an iPad or something similar. So, and my danger is, unless we do that, unless we kind of wholeheartedly embrace that, you're in real danger of creating a schism between young people who live in one technological era and their teachers who are trapped by lack of time or resource in a different one. And the loser there will become education, the thing we call education, because young people will decide that the whole thing is not relevant to them and their lives and their world and their futures.
I wonder if the biggest enemy in all of this are the parents. And by the parents, I mean the taxpayer. People often nominate education at the top of their list of priorities when they're polled because they, I think it's really kind of what they feel they ought to say that's the first issue they're concerned about. But really, unless you're prepared to pay the taxes to pay for the teachers and the smaller classroom sizes and those resources and the training and all those things, then it's not going to happen, is it?
Well, I think that's dismally true. I mean, there's also this extraordinary thing we have in the UK, and I'm sure it's true here, where property prices, to an extraordinary degree, relate to being near a successful school. I mean, you know, parents of young children will move miles to, because they know that a school, you know, 10 miles away is doing better, getting better results. Well, if you're prepared to do that with your life, presumably the idea of spending of your property taxes or your federal taxes going up a bit to underpin the quality of education, it should be a no-brainer. I tell you something I've looked at, and I hope this is useful to you. I looked at the whole issue of triage. You know what triage is?
Yes, separating the wounded from the...
That's right. Now, it's a kind of art form, and there are very, very precise rules for the way you do it. If you take the notion of triage and apply it to public expenditure in terms of how do you best use the resources and what are you going to save and what you're going to lose, it is absolutely evident to me that the only investment you must make is in education. Everything else, I'm afraid, is quite brutal at times, has to suffer, because only education ultimately can provide you with the pensions you want. Only education can provide you the health service you want. Only education can provide you the transport and public infrastructure you want. You can't do it the other way around. And I'm constantly amazed at the fact that, you know, many governments all over the world will talk a good game and not realise that the fundamental component that they require to push themselves through the 21st century and emerge as hopefully successful nations is the one that they still mess about with in terms of the way in which no country can afford the luxury of not being brilliantly educated. That would be my argument for the 21st century. It's an unaffordable luxury not to be brilliantly educated.
Are you able to influence that debate from your position in the House of Lords? You're not a minister, but are you able to actually have your views heard?
I certainly was at one point, and I certainly chime in now. I mean, obviously, I'm in opposition. Chime in now on these issues. I'm particularly lucky, and because of my luck, I'm having to be a little bit more cautious. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a chancellor of the Open University. The Open University has come out of all these recent debates and cuts and things in a rather good place. So, and you'll know this, the danger is the worst thing you can do in Britain is crow about the fact that you've managed to survive a crisis and in fact are in a better situation than you were before it, because everyone else is howling in pain.
Yeah.
So I'm just having to shut up.
Well, you're in Australia now.
And get my head down and take advantage of the good things that are happening to us.
Of course, cinema is such a larger part of your life. I want to return to that now. Where did you start in cinema? How did you get to start in cinema?
Well, it was absurd. It comes out to the 60s, really. I started in advertising, and I had a really great career in advertising, and I was a member of an agency that was a sort of phenomenon. In fact, probably the most flattering single thing that's ever happened to me is that Mad Men, in, I think, Series 3, the agency gets bought by a British agency, I don't remember.
Is that your agency?
And the agency was called Putnam, Powell and Lowe. Now, how about that? That is the most flattering thing that ever happened to me. I've never met Matthew Weiner. I'd love to. But it's just, I nearly fell off my chair when it happened.
In Mad Men, they're ruthless evil
they
bastards.
They are ruthless evil bastards. That's the bad news. That's the other reason I want to talk to Matthew Weiner.
But they can hold their martinis.
Anyway, so I had a great time in advertising. And at the age of 27, I think, you know, with the arrogance of youth and it being the 60s and knowing nothing, I said, well, what else am I interested in? Movies. That's what I do. I do movies. And that combination of ignorance and arrogance, if you like, which was not that uncommon in the 60s at all, is what projected me into cinema. I knew absolutely nothing, so much so that when Alan Parker and I were doing the very first movie, we actually had to go and steal a script so that we could type a script that looked like a script. We didn't know what scripts looked like. I mean, that's the level of ignorance we were coming from.
You arrived on the scene at the start of the New Hollywood, as it's called, and saw its its spectacular rise and then crash in the 80s as well. Yes. The new Hollywood, meaning the new generation of directors that came about, the films that came out, the Godfather movies, The Conversation, Easy Rider, and Mean Streets, the Scorsese's, the Coppola's, the Polanski's of this world, making truly great, vibrant new films. And then that gave birth to Steven Spielberg and to George Lucas. And with that, we get Jaws and Star Wars. Suddenly movies are serious money again. Yeah. Just tell me what that's like for you then, to observe this sudden explosion of, you know, the greatest films that Hollywood ever made, really. Let's be honest about that, you know, in that period. And then it's collapse afterwards.
Well, interesting enough, the first document I ever prepared related to movies, you know, and as bear in mind, I was coming out of advertising, I had a successful career in advertising, was called The Million Dollar Movie. And the reason I did it is because I was aware of all the debates going on about what films were costing. You know, The Star, Dr. Doolittle, all these films were costing multi-millions and the studios were losing money hand over fist. And we worked out that we could make a perfectly good movie for $1 million. And so I went along to a friend of mine who in turn introduced me to one of the studios and, with total ignorance, said, look, we can make your films for $1 million. And he said, that's not possible. I said, it's absolutely possible. We know how to do it. I'm going to use these people. And we did. And so the first three, four, five films I made were made for tiny sums of money. And fortunately for me, other than one, the second one was a disaster. But the first one, the third one, the fourth one, fifth one, all made money. And so I became A, acceptable, and B, by the time I did my third film, I was even beginning to get a grasp of roughly what I was doing. I mean, the first two films was just a series of embarrassments. I knew I had no idea what I was doing, but I was lucky and survived.
The writer Peter Biskin wrote that book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, about that period, this great upswelling of creative talent that came into Hollywood. And he said the thing that destroyed it in the end was these new Hollywood directors, Spielberg and Lucas, making those movies like Jaws and Star Wars, which, you know, very enjoyable films, of course, but they made so much money, that serious money, American money, then came into it. And Hollywood became a multi-billion dollar business. And that's what ruined it ultimately. That's what's ruined its creativity. Was that your experience in Hollywood?
To an extent, it was. I mean, maybe more interesting for you because you asked earlier a really good question about, you know, about the highs and lows and confidence and lack of confidence in Australian cinema. I feel I've lived through at least two absolute cultural revolutions. I actually think we're on the cusp of another one now. Now, let me typify those to you. When I entered advertising in 1958, it was run by men in bowler hats and furled umbrellas and pinstripe suits and one thing or another. And I was a messenger. It didn't really matter. By 1962, things were beginning to change, so much so that by the end of 60 or early 63, if you happen to be silly enough to come to work with a furled umbrella and a bowler hat, you're going to lose your job because the world had changed. Now, what had done that? Pirate radio, interesting enough, would be one. I call it the Radio Caroline moment. Pirate radio had just taken all the cultural assumptions and tossed them up in the air. So that happened then. When I got to Hollywood, when I first arrived, and this sometimes gets thought of as an anti-Semitic joke, so I must quickly say, my mum's Jewish, I'm allowed to say these things. The whole of Hollywood was run by four or five guys all called Sol, who were married to each other's sisters, who smoked large cigars and played gin rummy with each other at a weekend. That's the way it was. Within a year of me arriving, they'd all gone. They'd all gone. The Easy Riders, as you'd depict them, had chased them out of town, and Hollywood had changed dramatically. And so I've seen those two cultural revolutions. I know what can happen, and I believe that as a result of the digital explosion and sheer time and maybe the politics of the era we're living through, I think we're on the cusp of another one.
There's the great documentary Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now. Which I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I have.
There's a great moment at the end of it. Francis Ford Coppola, who's sort of like the extinct volcano of movies really these days, sadly. But he says, I see these new technologies coming along and I can't wait for the day when a fat girl from Iowa with a camcorder becomes the new Francis Ford Coppola. And all this Hollywood thing with its big salaries and billion-dollar budgets, it all just crashes to the ground. He can't wait to see the end of that. And I think I saw that doco about 10 years ago. We're not quite there yet, or are we? I don't know.
Oh, I think we are. I think we're rapidly there. I don't know if she's fat, but I've seen a couple of movies made by women from Iowa, and they're damn good, they're damn good films.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think, interesting, I'm thrilled you touched on this, the big thing that's taken place in the last couple of years, 18 18 months even, in cinema has been the feminization of cinema, the emergence, literally the emergence almost overnight, of dozens and dozens of really fine women directors. Now, interesting enough, Australia can genuinely put his hand up and claim to have started this with Jane Campion and Gillian all those years ago. But women directors have been very thin on the ground, few and far between. But now it's not the case. I would say around about 50% of the movies that I've seen in the last 12 months have been directed by women. 50%. Now, I do tend to see some slightly offbeat films, maybe, but that's extraordinary, and they are wonderful films. We're not talking about second-rate filmmakers here. So for the first time in my lifetime, cultural lifetime, you're actually seeing the world as it really is because you're seeing it through two quite separate pairs of eyes. Now, that has not been true up until now in cinema.
What do you see about the threat that shrinking attention spans have on cinema? I went and saw tomorrow when the war began, I should say, Australian movie, and it attracted a teenage audience. And it's interesting sort of sitting in a cinema with a bunch of teenagers these days because they're texting and checking their messages and checking Twitter right throughout the film. And they're tweeting each other and texting each other throughout the film as they sort of look at the screen, look at their smartphone, and they do that. So their faces are always being lit up by this little sort of glow all the time throughout the actual watching of the movie.
Well,
I wonder if that's you see that as a threat, or it's just something that we're just going to have to live with.
You and I have spent our lives, our respective lives, being told how brilliant women are at multitasking. I have no reason whatsoever to doubt that it is true. It could just be that we are encountering a generation that's even better at multitasking than we could have ever imagined. I'm not ready to condemn it yet. I do worry about it. I mean, as a one-time filmmaker, of course I worry about it. But then I used to go crazy every time anyone got up and went out for another bag of popcorn because that's not what I made films for. But I do suspect that their attention span is somewhat different from ours, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's any less precise.
David, you mentioned your father as the biggest influence on your life. What was it about him that you really loved and stayed with you today and made you the man that you are?
His values, the fact that he could basically take any complex issue and reduce it to what he felt was fair. My dad used the word fair more than any other word. I think he used it with great precision as well. Slightly unusual circumstance because I met him when I was five. He was away at the war when I was born. So he was an immense figure coming into my life when I was 5 years old, and he happened to be wonderful. And he was a big man, and I was just overwhelmed by him.
He could make an entrance into your
life.
He
made a massive entrance. Yes, exactly.
Because most of us, our fathers are there all along, so they don't make an entrance.
You, here's a little bittersweet story. I'm one of the very few people, I'm sure, that were ever able to do this. I did a movie called That'll Be the Day. It was the third film I made. And it was sensibly about myself and a friend of mine and how we grew up in the 50s. And it begins with a father coming home from war. And there's a very good actress. My son played me, standing at the front door of a house, which is a dead ringer for the house we were in, wearing the exact dressing gown. I wouldn't say, sorry, but exactly the same dressing gown that I was wearing because I remember it very well. And the man comes around the corner. It's at night. The mother says, "Go on, there's your dad. Go and meet him." Boy runs down the street. The father picks him up, hugs him, puts him on his shoulders, and he walks back down the house. Right, that's in the film. That is exactly what happened to me. Okay, my mum and dad are in the audience at the premiere. I'd never told them what I'd done. At the end of the film, I said, "Did you notice anything?" "No." I said, "Well, the opening of the film?" "No, they'd forgotten." I'd remembered every detail of it, and they'd forgotten.
How old were you?
Five
years old. What was your dad doing?
He was a photographer, press photographer. He'd had a fantastic job in the army. He'd been head of the army film unit in Italy for a long period of time, and the desert before that. He had a great war, and he came back to Associated Press, became picture editor because his eyes had been damaged during the war somewhat. And he was just a great, great man. I worshipped him.
Your achievements are very large. Did he give you lessons about achievement? I mean, aside from being fair, what about what you do well?
No, what he did was, look, in hindsight, there was never any such thing as a newspaper in our house as such. It was a good edition or a bad edition. The front page was well used. The story was great. Or he would say, "Do you know what? They've missed a trick here. There's a great story in page 3 that should have been on page 1. And he used to have those kind of strange things, you know, you do with a photograph where you can reduce or expand it. So he'd say, look, how much more powerful this photograph would have been if they'd only cropped it. So I got a kind of masterclass at breakfast, certainly at the weekends, on a critical masterclass on what a newspaper could look like. And then at the very last minute, I assumed I was going to go into Fleet Street. At the very last minute, he didn't want me to do that. He thought that advertising was more interesting. So when I was ejected from school or fled from school, I went became a messenger in an ad agency.
You provided me with the perfect segue now to talk about media now and and your role in the House of Lords overseeing media diversity. That's one of the big issues that's kept you very energetic in recent times. What's happening there at the moment that's causing? Because we don't really hear much of these media diversity debates.
Yeah.
Of the UK in Australia. What's got your interest there lately?
Well, I've got to give it a bit of context. In the 2002-2003, I happened to be, complete coincidence, I happened to chair what we call a joint parliamentary committee on what was then the Communications Bill. So it's the joint parliamentary committee, Lords and the Commons, looking at a draft bill and criticising it and suggesting changes to it. So I spent the best part of a year working on what was then the draft Communications Bill that became the bill. During the passage of that bill, I organised a rebellion of sorts, but an amendment that was opposed by both front benches, the Labour front bench and the Tory front bench, for a plurality test. And this was a public interest test, that in the event of takeovers, mergers or acquisitions within the media industry, they had to be subjected to a public interest test, and that public interest test would be determined by were you adding to or subtracting from the amount, the plurality of information available to listeners and viewers. So that was a very, and we won, miraculously, this backbench rebellion.
You ran a backbench revolt?
Yeah, and it won. So it went to law. It became the law. The law in Britain now, we have a law. It's my only law, where takeovers and mergers are judged against the plurality test. Now that's suddenly become a live issue because News Corp have decided to bid for the 61% of Sky that they don't own.
Now, Sky is the
digital satellite broadcaster. So we're potentially locked in battle again, and without doubt, this plurality test will be one of the tests under which this acquisition will be judged. Not the only test; there'll be other competition tests as well. But it's tremendously important. I am seriously concerned that we are looking at a situation where a News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, will control an obscene degree of our of media, which in turn gives enormous political power, unelected political power to that particular media group. And what's wonderful is that the other media groups have at last woken up and realised what the threat is. So I'm not on my own at all on this. There's a very, very large body of opinion. My own party at last has kind of bestirred itself as well, that is going to, I think, quite vociferously oppose this possibility.
I recently heard a speech from Rupert Murdoch where he complained that, where he said, "Don't persecute me for being successful." And I know I'm a parvenu, and I get stick for that as well. I think that was his thing. Mm. I don't come from high birth within Britain, and therefore, because I'm successful, he was implying that he's persecuted for his success. Are you one of those people he has in mind as someone who's tormenting him as just for being merely successful? Is he a persecuted man, Rupert Murdoch?
You know, an interesting thing. It's got nothing to do with Rupert Murdoch at all. There are two issues here. Number one, I don't think anybody, including the Queen, should be that powerful and should have that control of that level of the media, or should be able to be that influential with the politicians of the day, be they in opposition or in government. It's just wrong. It's not a democracy. It's a faux democracy. I actually said in Parliament last week, I've wanted to say this for years, that Britain is not a banana republic and it does itself no favours when it pretends to be. and it isn't. And banana republics emerge from being over-influenced by over-powerful people. So it's not about Rupert Murdoch. Anyone, as Alan Rushbridge said, even if David Attenborough owned these newspapers, I'd be worried. It's media assets. It isn't that. There's also the other sheer...
But nonetheless, you are standing in the way of him taking full control of probably the most profitable part of his entire empire in Britain, maybe worldwide. You know, if you go up against Rupert Murdoch on these things, you tend to know all about it, don't you, David?
Well, I've no idea. There is a weird thing here. I really admire the man as a businessman. He's daring. He's all those things that make successful businessman. He's daring. He takes chances. He doesn't certainly doesn't treat fools much. Doesn't give fools much space. But there is a point that worries me. I was once on a boat with three billionaires, perfectly nice guys. And actually, my purpose was to try and encourage them. I was president of UNICEF at the time, trying to encourage them to do some stuff for UNICEF. And we got around to what they really wanted in life. Now, where were they going? These were guys that ran big businesses. And only one word emerged that they were all kind of signed off on, is they wanted more. And I said, what do you mean more? They said, well, more is the only basis on which we can judge whether we're being successful or not. Because if we're not getting more, then we're not being successful. Now, the notion that we're tied into a world or an industry or a media where the object is to have more control, I find it horrifying, really, seriously horrifying. And the history of the way in which this is achieved is not very attractive. I mean, one of the things that Murdoch in particular consistently attacks the BBC, as though the BBC is somehow standing in its way of being as powerful as it would wish to be. The truth is, you project out the next 3 or 4 years, the Sky revenues will be almost two and a half times the size of the BBC. Two and a half times the size of the BBC. So this is not a small organisation being dominated by or damaged by a monolith. This is our public service broadcaster potentially being kind of wiped out in terms of its ability to buy anything on the open market by an organisation who has £2-3 billion worth a year of spare cash. So this is a big, big debate. I can deal with all of that. What I can't deal with is the issue of access to the Prime Minister, of influence the Prime Minister, and the fact, and I'm being absolutely candid, I'm a man of the left, Rupert Murdoch's a man of the right. Only one of us is going to emerge out of this with the kind of world that they want to live in. And I'm fighting for the world I want to live in.
David Putnam is my guest in conversation. Of course, media organisations, particularly privately owned ones, are undergoing extraordinary stress at the moment because of the fact that newspapers seem to be in real trouble. I just wonder how you see that playing out, if you see journalism at risk, or is journalism already debased to a point where it needs to be reinvented?
I can't give you a simple answer. I think the very, very best journalism is becoming available in ways it's never been available before. I mean, I've got a couple of apps on my iPad. One's called Stumble Upon, and another one is another sifting device which within the areas that specifically interest me will find the very best stuff that's being written on any in any given week. So my ability to find good journalism is absolutely there. And I think at the top end of the market, there's some fantastic stuff. I think the bottom end of the market probably does tend to get worse and worse and worse. And one of the great sadnesses of my lifetime is that, I mentioned my dad, and I mentioned 1945 because they're all of a piece with it, is there was a genuine belief in 1945, 1950, that the purpose of journalism was to kind of improve people's understanding of the world, to help them with the complexity of the world, to help them deal with their daily lives. We also had a couple of papers in London, weeklies. One was called Reveille and one was called Titbits. Okay. Now, no one pretended for 1 second that Titbits and Reveille were anything other than kind of comics with funny stuff in them and some very pretty girls and everything else. I don't think in my wildest dreams, and certainly in my father's wildest dreams, did he ever believe that the tabloid newspapers that were organs of change for him in the 40s and 50s would become Titbits and Reveille. I don't think it ever crossed his mind. And that in doing so, they would actually conspire in the general kind of absolute, I hate the phrase dumbing down, general levelling off of interest in complex issues. You know, you just mentioned that the election in this country was something less than an edifying spectacle. We've all got to take some responsibility for that.
Yes.
But it's about expectations. If the media expect more of politicians for the most part will deliver more. I've met a number of politicians in the last few weeks. They are not dumb people. Actually, they're extremely bright people. But they are people who, from time to time, have to pretend they're dumb or act dumb in order to satisfy what they see to be the appetite of the dumb media. And so what we've got into is a dreadful conspiracy to make ourselves all either appear to be or maybe in actuality less competent to deal with an ever more complicated world.
David, just finally, people hearing you talk there will... I mean, you're a very energetic man. You've done all these extraordinary things. Listeners will be astonished to hear that you've been living with a form of chronic fatigue syndrome for, 20 years now?
Yes, 22 years.
Does it still manifest... you haven't got it today, clearly. I've got you on a good day, I know that for sure.
I had it 2 days ago. I got a day. I'd only, thank God, one day. I had a bad day. It comes and goes. I'm very lucky. I mean, some people with chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME as I prefer to call it, have it. It is utterly debilitating. For me, it's 5, 6, 7 times a year. I know it's coming. My wife's brilliant at recognising it. And, yes, not very attractive. And one of the worst things about it, it comes with a depression. Depression is really a shitty thing to have. Anyone that's had it knows it. Anyone that hasn't had it should feel very sympathetic towards people who suffer depression.
So when it comes on, what do you do? Just take to your bed for a while and just wait through it? Or what do
you do? I know it's there, and I don't have the opportunity to take to my bed. I know it's there, and I manage it as best I can. I try, for example, not to make any decisions. I know that's absurd to make decisions because I would tend to be negative. But there's one good aspect to it. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of it and I am feeling rather depressed, you get a very, very realistic grasp of what's going on about you. So, for example, the answer I just gave you just now about my concerns about where society is going and the avoidance of complexity, a lot of that stuff stems from the fact that during periods of depression, I've been forced, if it were, to reflect on the fact that the world is not quite the sunny place I'd like it to be.
David Putnam, you're one of the most fascinating people I've ever spoken to on this program. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Bless you. Thanks for having me.
It's Lord David Putnam. He's in Australia to give the keynote address at the Asia Pacific Screen Awards.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.